we have suddenly encountered with the changes in the agenda. Our first speaker was unable to arrive here personally due to some visa issues, and we were not able to arrange his personal presence here, but we're going to do an online conference anyway. Kartik Ravindran with you right now on our video link is going to talk about the application lifecycle management software tools created for ALM. And we are going to cover a number of other topics during the day. We will have the first part last for an hour and a half, and it will be followed by a Q&A session. I will assist during the Q&As. We will start.
You too? I can't see you. Okay, great. Like, can you start your video? I can't see your side. Oh, it's my slides. No, I mean, can you start your video? I can't see you on the thing, so. Okay. Okay, I started the video. Oh, you want me to start the video again? Can you see my slides? Okay, so I'll go ahead and get started then, okay? Okay, great. So, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the ALM Summit. My name is Kartik Ravindran, and I'm a senior director in the ALM product management team. I'm accountable for product management for the ALM products and services shipped by Microsoft, and these include Team Foundation Server, Team Foundation Service, and the Visual Studio's queues and the ALM capabilities contained within them. So it's my absolute pleasure to be here this morning to present this kickoff session, and really wish that I could make it there in person, but had some visa challenges and wasn't able to get the visa in time to make it over. So, but still, we'll do the best that we can and make the session work. I still hope to make this a very valuable presentation for the folks, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics around how to think about ALM from the perspective of solution patterns, and specifically in the context of enabling modern business modernization opportunities that are starting to become very prevalent and significant in the IT industry today. So so my talk will essentially focus on a couple of key aspects. The first area that I'll end up spending a good amount of time on is on positioning and resonating a strong business case for investing in ALM. And the business case itself will be connected to this notion of business modernization, which I'll talk to shortly and explain what that means. And upon establishing a strong business case for ALM, I'll then dive into walking you through a set of solution patterns that can be applied from an ALM perspective to help enable business modernization opportunities. So that'll kind of be the overall structure of my talk. And my talk is really sort of going to focus on seeding a set of key thoughts that I would love to be able to land strongly with you folks. And these thoughts in turn will translate into the more deeper and drill down sessions that will follow this keynote, which will be delivered by Dimitri, Alex, and the rest of the team, during which you should be able to connect the concepts and points that we discussed during this keynote in a much more deeper context through the demonstrations and the sessions that they will dive into after me. So that being said, prior to diving in, we'll introduce myself a little bit more. So I've been in the industry now for about 15 years and have a combination of experience spanning product engineering and IT services engineering in those 15 years. 13 out of those 15 years I've been at Microsoft. By my current role, as I mentioned earlier, is the product management lead for the ALM offerings. So my experiences are a pretty broad mix. I started out in the consulting app dev industry as a consultant and worked for a company by name Cognizant Technology Solutions, and worked there for about 2 to 3 years, and then made my shift to Microsoft, where my journey first started in the developer support services team, where when I came on board about 13 years back, it was when .NET version 1.0 was just being released. So first came in a role that sort of like required me to support Microsoft developers who are building on our stack, and sort of like transitioned from the developer support role to product engineering, first within the Visual Studio product group, and then to Microsoft Dynamics, where I helped build the business intelligence services that you see in Microsoft Dynamics AX today. And after my stint in product engineering, I did a field stint where I had the opportunity to sort of serve as a director of architecture evangelism. And the areas that I focused on included our information worker platform, which is Office and SharePoint, and our web development stack. And from my architecture evangelism role, I then transitioned into services engineering in the Xbox Live division. And within the Xbox Live division, I focused on engineering the digital supply chain services, which first started out as a project that was targeted specifically at the Xbox Live business, and which later matured to becoming a services that enabled other business groups within Microsoft, such as Microsoft Retail and Office and Windows and so on. So I did that for about 3 to 4 years, and it's after that role that I now stepped into my current functioning as the product management lead for ALM. So my immediate role prior to my current role is that in the digital supply chain services group, where I served as the senior director of engineering. And you'll notice a point here in the slide which talks about me rediscovering ALM in this role. So it was one of the most fascinating journeys of my professional career, where when I first started out in the team, the organization was a very traditional waterfall-centric IT group. And over the course of 3.5 years, we sort of transitioned from being a waterfall and sequential group to being a highly agile organization, which truly transitioned from just delivering IT projects to delivering services at a continuous velocity. And services engineering is a very different set of challenges and opportunities than traditional box product or IT project engineering. And we'll talk a little bit more about services engineering later in this presentation. But during that role, I had the opportunity to apply a number of the ALM solution patterns that I'll be introducing to you during this talk. And hopefully a lot of that would result in some valuable information that you can take away and look at applying within your respective organizations. So as far as my passions, I mean, on the technology side, very passionate about continuous learning and development. So always consider myself to be part professional, part student. And I mean, in this industry, with the pace at which things evolve, learning never stops. So I'm sure the same is the case with every one of you as well. And that's something that I personally hold very near and dear to my heart. So having said that, I'll now dive right into the first topic of this keynote, which will focus on this notion of business modernization and the role of ALM in enabling business modernization. And what I'd like to do at this point before diving in is have Dimitri play a short video on, and this video is basically going to walk you through a case study around a setup called the Nordstrom Innovation Lab. So Nordstrom is a very popular retailer in the U.S. And within the Nordstrom enterprise, there's been a significant investment in setting up a lean startup type IT organization that executes in agile cycles to build out new apps and services that help Nordstrom connect better with its consumers and generate revenue opportunities. So Dimitri will play the video, and let's take a look at the video, after which I'll dive into this section.
I'm JB Brown, the Nordstrom Innovation Lab Manager, and this is the lab. We work on one-week experiments. Somebody will have an idea, and we'll find a way to figure out how to prove if the idea is going to work. The Nordstrom Innovation Lab is a lean startup inside of a Fortune 500 company. A typical day in the Innovation Lab starts at about 9:30, where we'll have our stand-up meeting and figure out what we're going to do for that day and what we're going to try and accomplish. Once we've done that, our work is visible on our Kanban board, and people then start pulling work throughout the day to knock off what we're trying to accomplish. And then at the end of our week, we have a retrospective meeting where we talk about not necessarily about the work we accomplished, but how we do as a team. We may create a prototype, a working prototype of software that we write. We may also just create a presentation based on leaner methods. So paper prototype will draw things out and then put them in front of people and say, okay, what would you click on now? And they use a pen to say what they're going to click on and then determine if it's a good solution. And if it is, then work on a more functioning prototype. The most exciting part about working at this pace is the team that works on it bonds together, and just a community of people that just want to work together and find out the real results. It's really fun, and you don't have to have that red tape getting in the way. As we evolve and have new competitors, we will need to take risks but not lose money while we're taking those risks. So the gains are always a market opportunity so you get more customers or push your brand out to more people. The reason you'd want something like this in your company is because startups out in the industry are going to be doing this anyway, so you might as well take advantage of it and benefit from it instead of having them be competitors and having them come up with the new, fast, cool idea. Should do it ourselves and have it be Northrop.
Great, so is the video done? Awesome. Great. So that was an example of a pretty large enterprise within the US, which is Nordstrom, and how they are looking to innovate in their IT and software investments with agile teams and practices, and sort of like really embracing and adopting some of the emerging trends and opportunities that technology enables for them to better connect with their customers, for them to increase their customer satisfaction, and in the process sort of grow their revenue opportunities in the retail business. But some of the common themes and trends there sort of line up very well with the next set of topics that we will talk about, one of which is introducing the notion of business modernization, and the second, which will basically drill into real challenges and opportunities of relevance to the IT business in enabling such modernization initiatives. So in terms of business modernization, the theme itself is pretty simple. I mean, the notion here is that the online world and the web ecosystem has evolved at dramatic scale over the past few years. And the notion of services is sort of far extended beyond just web services to sort of like services that can power a wide variety of connected device experiences for users across the globe. These days, it's very common for users to sort of like assume that they would always be in a connected state, or for them to have an expectation that they would be in a connected state, and not just be in a connected state, but also expectations of wanting to be engaged with by their service providers and by companies that they do business with, so that they always have that ongoing engagement and conversation with their service providers. So in terms of business modernization, there are some significant movements that are starting to emerge. The advent of technology and the web is starting to introduce new monetization and cost reduction opportunities, and better ways for organizations to connect with their consumers with lower scale investments. Computing power that is now being provided as services in the cloud that can help democratize IT infrastructure and help organizations lower their operational costs. Enterprises and organizations of all sizes are starting to invest and think hard about how can they directly establish connections within their consumers through a variety of different devices and channels that their consumers are starting to become proliferant and are constantly being engaged from within. The mobility and devices revolution is now starting to drive movements where pretty much the majority of consumers today can be expected to be carrying with them mobile devices like phones and tablets, which sort of put them in an always connected state, thereby presenting both opportunities and challenges to businesses of all sizes. The opportunity is that now businesses have a gateway, an always on and connected gateway to connect and relate with their customers. The challenges are in the context of IT being able to enable the services and applications at scale that are needed to enable such direct connections with their consumers. And these connections need not always be about monetizable transactions. More often than not, the connections are about the more subtle and softer engagements and interactions with consumers that then lead to monetizable transactions. But the importance of being connected and engaged with your consumers has never been at a higher priority than where it is today with the advance of technology and mobility. There are other interesting trends that are also starting to catch pace, such as the notion of gamification, which is essentially the notion of how can you take your consumer experiences and start gamifying them? Like, can you bring in the notion of games in the way in which your apps and your services interact with your consumers? There are some industries where this particular trend is catching on more highly than not. For example, the fitness industry, the healthcare industry, the retail industry, all of these are industries where enterprises and organizations are really thinking hard about how can they build direct-to-consumer applications and services that have a game notion to them, which would then appeal to their target demographics and help get people more engaged in those experiences. And last but not the least is the pressure of compete velocity, where organizations, there are many organizations that are already starting to jump the bandwagon on these kinds of investments, and organizations in a similar compete domain are constantly being put under a pressure from the compete velocity to also step up and execute with the needed pace. But collectively, all these opportunities are being commonly referred to today in the industry by a term known as the consumerization of IT. And when you hear the term the consumerization of IT, the way we think about it and break it down is as shown in this particular view that is now being presented to you. There are two aspects of the consumerization of IT. The first aspect being that consumers and your business users within your organization are becoming extremely technology savvy, are mobile, expect to be always connected, and these expectations and trends in turn demand the best out of IT and services to enable best fit experiences for your audiences. And these experiences in turn can almost always be connected to business benefits such as the growth of revenue, cost reduction, and or users' customer satisfaction. There's also the angle of consumerization of IT where computing services are these days being provided to organizations, like how normal services such as electricity and water and whatnot are being provided, have been provided to consumers for many years in the past. So cloud computing now sort of brings to surface the paradigm where computing power, computing infrastructure, and platforms can also be sort of acquired in a commodity model and can be paid for on a paper usage basis, which starts introducing very interesting dynamics in how you can think about scaling your computing investments and related dollar spend. At the bottom, there's a very core point here, which is that in order for the business to be able to materialize any of these modernization opportunities, IT has a significant role to play as an enabler. I mean, without the right IT investments, without the right technology and software investments, it is impossible to take advantage of and realize the benefits of these business modernization opportunities. So this truly is that time in the industry when the notion of business and IT coming together and integrating as one in enabling an organization is really starting to take that mainstream role and play in a very broad context. Another pivot for you to think about in the context of business modernization is to get a better look at what exactly are some of these kinds of investments. So in the video that Dimitri just played to you, you sort of got a short taste of some of those investments. That was a fairly short video. The video played for about a minute and a half. I would strongly recommend you to go and check out the actual Nordstrom Innovation Lab website, where they have a 6 to 10 minute video that actually will show you a lot more scenarios that they are building out and starting to evolve. So the key thing for you to keep in mind here is that the IT investments these days are not just about building traditional line of business systems. Traditional line of business systems, also known as systems of record, or ERP, CRM, and custom line of business applications that you've been building to date, are just one category of investments that IT departments and organizations need to think about. There is this other set of modern apps that are starting to emerge, which are directly connected to the notion of the consumerization of IT. And one way to think about these apps is to look at them as systems of engagement. So systems of engagement, as in these are applications or services that help organizations connect directly with their consumers and customers, that help organizations establish more high-scale connections with their partners, that help organizations mobile-enable their workforce so that their workforce can take advantage of these IT consumerization benefits to grow the organization. So specific investments in this category include things such as cross-platform commerce experiences, where commerce itself has evolved from being just electronic commerce through a website to now supporting the notions of mobile commerce, social commerce, and then eventually connecting consumer commerce experiences across all these different edges. Investments in other direct-to-consumer services, such as engaging users in your product ideation, engaging users in product support and feedback. All of these are great opportunities where organizations can establish direct connections and relationships with their customers, thereby constantly looking for opportunities to engage and drive monetization opportunities. Mobile workforce enablement is another very key scenario. Workforces these days are mobile. Many enterprises are geographically distributed. And most employees within organizations have affinities towards certain types of mobile devices, be it tablets or phones or whatnot. And enabling and empowering employees within an organization to take advantage of their device affinities and to be able to drive business workloads using those devices as experience channels enables high productivity and result yielding opportunities for enterprises and organizations of all sizes. Gamification, we spoke about that a little bit, which is essentially how do you think about taking your consumer experiences and giving them a gamifying or a game notion to make it more interesting to them. And last but not the least, even the traditional notions of enterprise BI are starting to evolve into scenarios such as audience intelligence and consumer intelligence. But the main difference between your traditional line of business apps and these modern apps is the sheer scale at which your software and your services need to be able to operate. There are some very, very fundamental shifts in the demands of IT infrastructure and scale when making this transition or when crossing the chasm from traditional applications to these modern applications, such as the shift from macro transactions to micro transactions. The volume at which your transaction scale would increase when you open up commerce experiences across a connected devices across a set of connected devices would be unlike anything that you would have experienced if you only serviced transactions that occurred through a brick and mortar store. The volume of transactions that you would have to be able to process once your workforce gets mobile enabled would be way greater than what you are processing than what you are probably processing today with just on-premise software. And finally, to be able to track every action of your consumers in this highly connected world, and then to be able to run analytics to interpret information out of all the data, requires BI systems to also be able to handle much larger workloads and information processing capabilities. So all of these collectively sort of like increase the demands on IT in a couple of key areas. One area is in the context of how do you think about infrastructure? How do you scale an infrastructure sustainably to meet these demands? And the second area is around how do you fundamentally rethink your engineering practices to be able to deliver software at this tremendous velocity and on a continuous basis? So these are some significant sort of like shifts in the context of software development, all of which will eventually bleed into the significance and relevance of ALM to enabling such opportunities. What should also be noticed is that many times these systems of engagement will also have to interact with the systems of record. So for instance, when you have a highly distributed commerce experience, the transactions, whether micro or macro, from within those commerce experiences have to eventually get logged into your financial systems. So the breadth at which you start scaling out the systems of engagement will also have a direct impact on the scale expectations of your systems of record. Because eventually your transactions have to find their way into your ERP systems and into your other enterprise BI systems from where they can be managed. So Not only do these systems of engagement introduce scale and velocity opportunities and challenges for IT, but they also end up introducing such requirements that need to be met by your traditional systems, which now need to scale to support and integrate with such workloads. So this slide here is just to give you a broader overview and a little bit more of a drill down into what is specifically meant by business modernization investments and the relevance of such investments to your business. The business of IT, put in very simple terms, is all about business enablement and modernization. IT exists to serve the business. It exists to evolve the business, and in the context of modernization, it has a significant enabling role to play in helping modernize the business. Now, as an IT practitioner, there are certain key priorities that are very, very important to you. And these include priorities such as making sure that your IT team can at all times stand toe-to-toe with your business expectations and requirements to help take your business forward. But in the process of doing that, there are also real challenges around making sure that not only can you move with agility, but that you can also balance that agility with quality and scale and compliance and not compromise any of these critical edges. That is a really tough challenge, of balancing agility with the aspects of quality, scale, and compliance, all of which are expected as and capabilities. Finally, there's the notion of maximizing economies of scale. Like, how do you make sure that your infrastructure and your development investments are optimally tuned in the context of the operational spend and costs that are needed to support them? But if you take all these challenges and opportunities that you have to deal with as an IT professional, eventually the success of the effectivity of your investments, the success of the effectiveness of your execution gets measured by the business value that the software and the IT investments are yielding for the organization. So the first metric is the faster time to market. Businesses are becoming increasingly demanding. Business groups within enterprises are starting to become really demanding in the context of the cycle times and the velocity with which they expect software to be delivered to enable opportunities. And with that velocity comes the expectation of a continuous loop of value delivery, where the value delivery itself could be a combination of one or more of growing adoption, growing revenue, reducing operational costs, and fundamentally increasing your customer satisfaction and user love, which in turn helps you generate more revenue for your business. So all of these different challenges and opportunities that an IT organization needs to be able to deal with eventually also have to map to the fundamental notion of success, which gets measured by the velocity and agility with which value can be continuously delivered. And the Nostrum video, the Nostrum Innovation Lab video, was a great example of an enterprise within which the IT team has started mobilizing such workforces to go out there, explore such modernization opportunities in the retail context of relevance to Nostrum, and to start driving more agile practices and agile engineering investments and adoption of technologies that can help support such scale to realize the consumer attraction and the consumer retention value that could be enabled by such software investments. So this slide here is kind of like the core purpose here is to sort of communicate the message that the fundamental, like the business modernization initiatives, cannot be fulfilled without supporting IT investments to make happen. Software and IT technology has never been at a more exciting time in the industry today, and there exist tremendous opportunities to make such opportunities happen for your organization. Let's talk a little bit about the barriers to success, and specifically the topmost barriers to success. I mean, in a nutshell, what stands between an IT department or a software development organization from delivering continuous value and realizing the business benefits essentially boils down to a very common, well-known problem to which the solution has never been very simple. The problem is effectively the fact that releasing software or services of any kind requires a variety of different functions to come together and integrate and work together to deliver that value. And these are genuinely functions which have diverse and differing backgrounds that need to be able to integrate and function as one to land the value that can be delivered by software. But the reality today is in most IT organizations that tend to exist these barriers between these functions and key roles. Barriers that sort of like result in more of a waterfall or a handoff cadence in passing on workloads. Not just passing on workloads sequentially, but also in a lot of back and forth exchanges to resolve conflicts and disagreements that occur as the workloads get transitioned from face to face. When such barriers and non-optimal exchanges exist between these functions, essentially the net effect is that your cycle times to progress through the phases and your net cycle time to deliver software starts increasing significantly. Time is money, so when time starts increasing, your costs also start going up. And the real challenge here is no matter what you try, at the end of it, you end up delivering stuff that your users do not necessarily get excited about or are satisfied with. And all of these conundrums can then lead to sort of like lost value opportunities or the inability to be able to move faster at the pace that is needed to be able to land some of these newer business modernization opportunities that are now starting to surface. So the timing has never been more important in the context of the ability of IT organizations and business teams to collaborate and function as one in moving the needle forward in realizing those value opportunities. Another way to look at those barriers, which was shown in a more sort of logical context in the previous slide, is to now take a more engineering-centric pivot. So what we kind of show here is the notion of a life cycle, an application life cycle, which is broken down into three core segments. That is an ideation phase or a define phase, where the requirements of the application or the service get ideated and defined. And then there's a develop phase where they get implemented, and finally the operate phase, where the application gets deployed to production and is operated. The notion of the circle that you see here, the loop, it's not necessarily meant to just indicate the fact that processes need to be agile and not sequential or waterfallish. But there is a second significant element to notice about the loop, which is the notion of continuous value delivery. Software and services, when delivered in smaller batches, in smaller incremental batches, will enable organizations to experiment, will enable organizations to learn more about what works and what does not work, and then to feed the learning back into an iterative loop to continue to evolve investments in an actionable way. So the circle here is not just meant to indicate notions of agility, but it's also meant to indicate the notions of a continuous flow of software and a continuous flow of value in an environment and an organization that is committed to realizing the benefits of business modernization. But another key element to look at in the slide is the barriers that exist within the different edges, and in some cases, barriers that also tend to exist within a particular function or a particular edge of this iteration. So what is called out in this diagram are some of those common challenges which I think most of you would be able to recognize well with. I won't go through everything in this slide because we'll talk more about them in the patterns, but I will call out the top-level items. So there are a set of challenges which are associated with helping your users and stakeholders be more engaged in the software development process, helping your development teams engage your users and stakeholders in more effective ways in defining software requirements, in validating requirements, and in helping the development team prioritize requirements. The need to engage users and stakeholders in these processes is extremely, extremely critical, especially with the velocity at which software needs to be delivered these days, and with the fact that most of the value benefits are determined and defined by the stakeholders and users. It is essential to break the barrier that exists between define and develop and more deeply integrate those two functions and teams. The next set of challenges are within the development phase itself. So development teams themselves contain or consist of a variety of different functions. Project managers, product managers, architects, developers, testers. And there often tend to exist barriers even between the functions that make up a development team. And these barriers can lead to challenges such as loss of focus, they can result in a lot of back and forth exchanges between functions, all of which eventually end up impacting the total ability of the team to deliver software faster and with reduced cycle times. Then you have the challenge where when the software is finally built, there are times when your users are not deeply engaged, you end up running into situations where your user expectations are not met, and you discover those user expectations not being met very late in the cycle. The later you realize such issues, the more time-consuming it becomes to address them and to reiterate. Finally, when you manage to get past the development phase and get into the operate phase, you run into a whole new set of challenges. The very first one being the ops checklist, right? Which is pretty much every IT organization has requirements that applications and services have to meet before they can be deployed out into production. And in some cases, you get to the deployment phase and then realize or recognize that the operational criteria is not being met. One of two things happens when that happens. A, you might choose to make a trade-off, not meet the operational requirement, and still deploy into production, which could result in some significant pain and issues for the operations team. Or B, you might choose to not ship the software and go back to the table to address those operational concerns before going back and trying to redeploy it again. And that results in an increase in cycle time and a loss of time to get value to the market. Once you get past the barrier, then you run into the equation where the operations team tend to use a different set of tools than the development and the user teams. So now there's a disintegrated environment where the tools that is being used by operations do not connect to the tools that are being used to the development, and thereby making information exchange and collaboration cumbersome. Getting past the ops backlog, now you run into issues where no matter how much testing or how much quality enablement you might have built into your product cycles earlier, there will always be new learnings that you discover in production. Production is the only version of the truth in a services environment. And in some cases, you will have new learnings, learnings that basically validate or invalidate your assumptions about the value of a software product. Or there could be production incidents that you did not discover when you were testing in the downstream test environments earlier in the cycle. But in either of these cases, you have to be able to get actionable feedback back to the development team so that they can take action on it. So this includes diagnostics that help development teams resolve incidents with a low mean time to recovery. And it also includes objective metrics that are gathered about the business value generated by your software so that that value feedback can feed back into the business teams who are prioritizing the next set of requirements. So in other words, this loop that you see here is all about a continuous value delivery process. It's about doing, measuring, learning, and doing again and again and again. And to be really effective in such a loop, these barriers and these impediments that are shown here need to be addressed or resolved. So the fundamental context or concept here is that when you have a team without barriers, when those barriers do not exist between the different functions and the roles within the function, your teams can genuinely hit the point of achieving this continuous flow of value, which we are starting to talk to as the notion of continuous value delivery, where the value itself sort of translates to business benefits, such as faster time to market, increase in revenue, operational cost reduction, and eventually high satisfaction from your users and your customers. And being able to achieve such business benefits while balancing agility with quality is the key conundrum and challenge that IT organizations of all sizes have to be able to address and deal with. But the utopian state and the state that we all want to strive and get to is this notion of no team barriers, and what can we do to basically try and get to such a state. Which now brings us to our core topic, which is ALM, because ALM, when done right, can be a significant enabler of business modernization and the notion of continuous value delivery. ALM is one of these highly controversial terms which, depending on who you talk to, you could end up getting a very different definition. If you talk to five different people and ask them what is ALM, chances are you will get five different responses. The reality today is that many people tend to equate ALM to the notion of source code management and version control. But ALM as such is way beyond that. It's not just about source code management and version control. It's not just about governance. It's not just about compliance. The fundamental cause and notion of ALM, if really simplified down to very simple terms, is about enabling teams without barriers. And when you have teams without barriers, you can truly be agile in your own way. So you notice here that in the text that reads agile your way, the A in the agile is actually in a lowercase, and it's been explicitly underlined. The reason for that is because we in Microsoft truly believe that every team has a different set of dynamics, and teams have to be able to figure out what is the best way for them to be agile in the context of the environment that they need to exist in. Agile with a capital case A emphasizes formal agile practices such as Scrum or Kanban or whatnot, where there can be like tremendous debates amongst purists about what does that entail and what does it not entail. That's a very interesting philosophical debate to get into, but that's not the goal and the notion of what we are trying to drive to here in the context of ALM. Our thinking here is more along the lines of how do we best enable you to be most successful and most agile within the context of your organization and within the context of the boundaries that you need to be able to operate within. But agility in its true sense is more behavioral. Agility in its true sense is more cultural than it is about sort of like a particular methodology or process. So if you think about the problem as people, process, and technology, when you have the right people who are empowered to define the right processes, and when those processes and people are enabled by efficient technology, you can get the best out of your ALM investments. So ALM in a nutshell is about enabling teams without barriers. And the capabilities that you need to look for in an ALM solution are capabilities around the notion of integration. Can you achieve end-to-end integration all the way from your users and stakeholders to your development team and all the way through to your operations teams? Can you really close that loop with the solution investment that you make in ALM? Can you achieve end-to-end traceability between all the way from your requirements to the code that is implemented, to tests that are executed to validate the code, through to the operational deployments and the value that is measured in production? Can you have end-to-end traceability across your workloads? Are there solutions in place to enable effective collaboration between the various functions that need to integrate to deliver software? Users, development teams, functions within the development teams, and operations. And can these solutions support agile practices in a way that makes the most sense to your organization? When a solution can enable these kinds of benefits, the net overarching benefit that you gain is faster cycle times. Faster cycle times to get from requirements to working software. Faster cycle times even just to get from an idea to the requirements. Faster cycle time to get from implemented software to tested software. And finally, faster cycle times to get all the way from working software through to deployed software and through the loop all over again. So reducing the cycle times through effective teams without barriers can be summarized as the core value prop of ALM. When done right, this in turn ends up enabling the notion of continuous value delivery, which we spoke about earlier, right? And this essentially is the notion of enabling faster time to market, new revenue opportunities, new cost reduction opportunities. And cost reduction is not always just about tangible money. It's also about the intangibles associated with reducing the cycle times in your development workloads. Time is money. When you can do your best to reduce the time and the cycle times between the various phases and steps, you automatically end up saving and reducing costs. And when such value ends up getting delivered on a continuous incremental basis, the user and the customer satisfaction can also grow to newer heights. Not just by the fact that the software is being delivered faster, but also based on the fact that the users are more engaged in the software development process in helping ideate, validate, and scope the software that needs to be delivered. And when all of this is done well, you'll get to a state where you can truly realize the value opportunities that software can enable for business modernization. So that was the lead-in in the context of setting up a business case for ALM. And what this next section will now do is dive into solution patterns. And for those of you who are familiar with the notion of design patterns, think of these as essentially a similar concept, but now applied in the context of specific solutions that ALM can enable for your organization. And each of these solution patterns will emphasize addressing one or more of the issues that we talked about earlier when talking about the notion of team barriers and functional barriers. So in summary, the solution patterns can be categorized into six main buckets that you see here. And what I will do during this talk is briefly introduce you to each of these buckets and the thought process behind the buckets. And you're going to have a session later on in the day that that Alex would be delivering, during which he will again revisit these patterns, but he will spend time drilling into these patterns in more detail and in showing you some live demonstrations of product scenarios that will show you how these patterns can be materialized. What I will do is basically introduce you to the theoretical concepts of these patterns, and specifically in the context of the business problems that they can help you solve. And we'll also show you some high-resolution screenshots of capabilities to give you a taste of some of the product features. But what I'll not be doing is going too deep into these patterns or kind of like running any live demonstrations to help communicate those points. Those are aspects that will be covered at depth in the follow-on session that you'll have later in the day. But that being said, it's really important that before you listen to that session, that you first get the essence of what each of these patterns are about. So first, let's start with a myth, right? So there exists a myth, which is ALM is an all or nothing deal. Agility is an all or nothing deal. It's either you go completely agile or you can be agile. Or it's either you adopt ALM in its whole or you cannot be successful. Neither is true. The reality is that these solution patterns are designed so that you can pick the patterns that address the problems that are most sensitive to your organization. Every organization is different. In the earlier impediments view that we had walked through, some of those impediments may not exist in your organizations. Some of those impediments might exist. Some of the impediments might be a higher priority than others. So there needs to be a selective approach where you can pick the area where you have the maximum pain and apply a solution to help you overcome that pain and gain better efficiencies. And then based on that experience, you can then look for other opportunities where you could also apply similar solutions to start helping your teams operate without barriers and disconnects. So the whole idea of these patterns is not to say like you have to apply all six patterns, but it really is to give you a set of food for thought, which you can then take and look at in the context of your organization to determine where do you have the maximum pain, and then try and apply patterns and solutions that can help solve those specific pain points. And then over time, you can look to mature and grow more broadly into other areas which you may not be tapping into today, but which could also be beneficial to your causes. So what we'll now do is walk through each of these patterns. In a nutshell, these patterns are about how can you engage better with your users and when should you be engaging with them? How can you think about breaking down your software into smaller and frequent releases? How do you think about baking quality into every phase of your development lifecycle? And in the process of doing that, how do you think about using the right testing practices and the right testing tools for each context? Then there's the aspect that once you start implementing and producing software, you are going to run into situations where certain unknowns get discovered late. You will run into situations where certain things might happen that you may not have expected. And when such situations occur, how can you and your users and stakeholders collaboratively pivot and adjust your directions to still deliver value within the time frame that you have sort of like set yourself to achieve? And finally, there's the notion of DevOps. The development of the operations teams, which always get looked upon as sort of like foes or as being at opposite ends of the spectrum, can truly integrate and partner in a very effective way to make sure that your last mile velocity, or essentially the time that it takes to actually address your last mile workloads of deploying, operating, and maintaining software, can also be a lot more faster and efficient. So that being said, let's dive into these patterns and spend some time talking about them. So the way each of these patterns are broken down is that the patterns are all sort of, each pattern is targeted at addressing a specific problem. And the problem itself is described in like very layman terms. And then for a given problem or a set of problems, that is a solution, where the solution itself is the pattern. And then each pattern comprises of a set of recipes that you can choose from. You don't have to apply all the recipes. You may figure out that one or more of these recipes work best for you, or you may figure out that only one recipe really works for you, in which case you could apply that. And eventually, what's the business value that you can actually expect to get by solving these problems? So the very first pattern is about collaborative ideation. Users have a very critical role to play in helping define the value of software. Unfortunately, in traditional IT, the medium that is adopted to sort of communicate with users are laborious documents like business requirements specs and functional specifications, and sort of like artifacts that don't necessarily directly reflect the specifics of the software that is being built. It is very hard to visualize a consumer experience in text versus actually being able to instead visualize it in a visual form that users can connect and relate to. So the classic problem here is about getting to more actionable collaborative artifacts that can be utilized to help define requirements in a more clear manner, and also in a clear manner that will help prevent later unknowns or later churns when the delivered software does not meet user expectations. The other challenge with most of the textual documents or the BRD and the spec processes is that the time that gets taken up to review and to approve such documents can be pretty time consuming. Because text and words and language can be very subjective, and the interpretation of language and terms can also be very subjective. And such subjective interpretations can often lead in different interpretations of what is being meant, thereby often resulting in cases where what the user is saying and what the development team is trying to build may not necessarily be the same, causing end-game churns and end-game delays in shipping your software. So the fundamental goal of this pattern is to focus on how can you pull your users together into more collaborative envisioning processes to define the right software. Because when you start your process by defining the right software, you're already solving a number of potential downstream quality issues proactively in the ideation phase. So there are a bunch of different recipes that can be applied in this context. Using storyboarding tools, you know, simple tools where you can sit side by side with your users and storyboard a software experience in a way that is meaningful to them. Prototyping is a slightly more advanced form of storyboarding. So storyboarding is more like you use a tool where you don't have to write any code or where you don't even have to write any scripts. Versus prototyping is a little bit more advanced, where there's actually some dev efforts to set up some seed data, to write some basic code, to do some basic UI mockups. And that's a little bit more advanced in storyboarding, but which is also not necessarily like a full-featured product per se. Visual modeling artifacts, right? So being able to utilize some of the more higher-end UML diagrams like use case diagrams, activity diagrams, sequence diagrams, all of which can be used effectively to talk with a business analyst and to validate and confirm system functional requirements. And all of which can be way more effective than trying to describe similar requirements using just plain text in a document. And then last but not the least is the notion of acceptance test-driven development, which is during the process of ideation also starting to clearly capture the functional criteria, the functional acceptance criteria that a piece of software needs to be able to satisfy for it to be considered to be done. So a good ALM solution that addresses this problem of collaborative ideation should give you a variety of options that can help you implement one or more of these recipes in materializing the benefits of this particular of the problems that this pattern tries to solve. So Alex will walk you through some live demos during the drill down session, but what I will show you is like one top level screenshot of a new capability that we are introducing in the next release of Visual Studio. And this is specifically what we refer to as storyboarding. And in this particular case, the storyboarding experience is deeply integrated inside Microsoft PowerPoint. So this essentially means that not only your product managers, but also your users and stakeholders can open up PowerPoint and drag and drop shapes from a vast library. So out of the box, we have a library that includes shapes that are metro apps, that are mobile apps, that are web app centric. And essentially, users can shift to the storyboarding tab and start laying out UIs that start mimicking and representing the intent of the experiences that need to be delivered. So typically, the way we recommend the tool being used is for a product manager or for a development team to work hand-in-hand with their users in mocking up the experiences that they wish to see come alive, and to sort of like then provide these mockups and experiences back to the development team to go implement. Now, during the live demonstration, you will see a scenario where if you look at the storyboarding tab at the ribbon, and if you look on top towards the right-hand side corner, you will notice that there is a ribbon button called Storyboard Links. And what Storyboard Links will allow you to do is that it will allow you to take a storyboard that you create and link it or connect it to a backlog item in TFS. So you could have a user story or a product backlog item to which you can take a storyboard and attach it onto. So what that then enables is that the developer or the team member who's assigned the task of implementing the scenario will then have direct access to the actual storyboard that he can then look at to understand what needs to be built. And further, what can also be done beyond that is that you can then, once the software has been implemented, you can initiate like user feedback loops. So you can have continuous loops where your users can be sent requests to provide feedback on the evolution of either the storyboard or the working software itself. And by engaging your users in these kinds of collaborative ideation activities, you can have a constant pulse on what their requirements are. And you can also shift to a cadence where you can block and tackle any unknown problems earlier in the cycle versus later. So you can expect to see some live demonstrations of this capability in the session that Alex will do for you later that drills down into this. The next pattern is around the notion of smaller batches and faster releases. So the Nordstrom video that you got a brief introduction to sort of like showed a cadence where the teams were rapidly iterating and working interactively, not just amongst themselves, but also with their customers to incrementally deliver value over a series of releases. For pretty much every one of the modernization investments that we spoke about earlier in this presentation, whether it is mobile enablement, whether it is direct-to-consumer services or whatnot, this whole notion of being able to iterate, to be able to do, measure, and learn on a continuous basis so that you're progressively evolving your investments with objective data points is a very, very critical concept to make sure that you understand. Because this is basically about taking the traditional Big Bang approach to delivering software and transforming that to a cycle which is a lot more faster and incremental and where the value needs to be delivered in smaller batches. This pattern, while may not be extremely sort of like contextual or connected to the traditional ERP and line of business type systems, is very, very relevant to the systems of engagement type investments. Because in the systems of engagement investments, that needs to be a constant feedback loop with the actual end consumers and users of the software experiences. And very often, the learning of what works and what doesn't work will end up happening as a result of executing do, measure, learn loops. But beyond that, the other benefit is that when you do break down releases into smaller incremental batches, it gives the team the opportunity to make course corrections on a faster basis. It gives the team to take some informed risks and to fail fast if the risks sort of start materializing. And it also gives the users the benefit of being able to continuously keep experiencing newer value through an incremental flow of software delivery. So the basic thinking here is around the notion of helping users and teams collaborate to take their ideas, to take their requirements, and to prioritize those requirements, and then to incrementally scope those requirements across a set of delivery iterations or sprints. So in the Nordstrom sample that we walked through, the delivery iterations and sprints are on a weekly basis. A weekly basis might be too fast for some organizations, which is not too bad. So 2 weeks or 3 weeks isn't bad either. But at the same time, it's also important to have a certain stick in the ground. So typically, a 4-week sprint is considered to be like about the maximum to which we would recommend pushing a delivery iteration. 4 weeks is a good enough amount of time to get a reasonably good idea of a problem statement or a value opportunity, and then to iterate in a rapid cycle to try and bring that opportunity to life. And then based on the learnings that you gain from the first iteration, to be able to continue to invest and evolve further. So this idea here is really all about how do users and development teams work together to collaboratively define and scope and prioritize requirements in an incremental basis. When done well, this will help you achieve faster time to market, and most importantly, it'll help you have a continuous flow of value through your software processes. So specific scenarios that you can expect to see in demonstrations in the session later today are around sort of the agile backlog management and sort of like delivery iteration planning capabilities that help users and development teams come together in planning these smaller batches, which then enable faster releases of value. The next pattern talks about acceptance test-driven development. In a nutshell, this leads into a broader pattern around quality enablement, which I'll talk about next. But the fundamental concept here is that quality shouldn't be treated as an afterthought. Like, usually testing in many cases ends up being a function that occurs in a sequential fashion, after the development process, versus in a truly agile organization that embraces the notion of test-driven development or acceptance test-driven development, quality is an element or a key factor that is accounted for from the very early phases of development, all the way from software ideation. And the notion of ATDD, or acceptance test-driven development, is about getting very specific on what does it mean to be done? What does it mean for a piece of software to be done for a particular iteration? And a key concept to think about here is the notion of a minimally viable product or a minimally viable service. What is the minimum amount of value that a product or a service has to be able to deliver in the context of an iteration for it to be useful to your customers and your users? And once you have the definition, how do you then take that definition and break it down into testable requirements? So a key concept or term for you to get familiar with is this notion of testable requirements. When you have a set of backlog items that you have prioritized, and when you're able to break down each item into a set of testable requirements, where the testable requirements span areas such as functionality, the user interface, architectural requirements, quality of service requirements, which could be performance or performance under load situations, operational requirements, such as the monitoring and the alerting capabilities that the service needs to have, and not to forget, business value expectations, such as validating assumptions that an investment could help grow revenue or reduce costs by a certain factor. But every one of such needs, when captured as testable requirements in your backlog, will then help your development and testing teams to focus on making sure that those testable requirements are being met. When every defined testable requirement for a piece of functionality gets addressed, you get to software that actually achieves the criteria of done and which ends up meeting the requirements of not just your users, but your broader set of stakeholders. So stakeholders is a fairly broad team. Operations is a stakeholder in software development. Architecture is a stakeholder in software development. And being able to account for the requirements that each of these stakeholders have in an explicit way when you plan your software, specifically by breaking down each investment into testable requirements and by making sure that those testable requirements are being constantly met and validated, will help you drive towards better overall quality in your software. When done right, the business value that you gain is that the delivered software will meet your stakeholders' expectations. So here is an example of a pretty compelling build status report, which upon every build of your software will give you a view into the progress against each of the scoped user stories. So in this particular case, if you look at the items on the left, these are not necessarily engineering features. This is a report that you can take and sit and have a conversation about with your stakeholders. Because what you see on the left is essentially a listing of user scenarios or user stories or user capabilities that have been scoped for a particular delivery iteration. And the interesting thing to notice in this report is that for each of those user stories, with every build, you get a report that tells you how much progress has been made on implementing that user story, and which also goes beyond that to look into the remaining effort, to look into the number of tests that have been defined for each of these user stories, data points about how many tests are passing versus how many are failing, and statistics on active defects or bugs that are being tracked. Now, when you start seeing bug counts like 6 and 2 and 2, all of which add up to like 10 or 11 bugs like in your delivery iteration, in a traditional IT context, those bug counts might be concerning to a manager or a developer. But in an agile context, when these kinds of counts surface early in the cycle, it's actually a very good thing. Because what this means is that you are catching defects early in your life cycle, which you can fix early, so that the cost of addressing those defects later in your life cycle starts getting reduced. So in a truly agile testing environment, and in a test-driven development environment, where you have tests that are being implemented along with your code, or maybe even before your code in some cases, will help you catch, detect, and fix bugs sooner in the cycle. So a new way to think about quality is a positive trending, where early in your life cycle, you actually get a lot of defects, which is a good thing because it tells you that your testers are doing what they need to be doing and that your developers are on their toes in the context of meeting those quality bars. And then looking for a positive trend where the bug count starts reducing as you progress through the iteration and the life cycle, eventually to the point where as you get towards the end of the life cycle, your bug count starts getting to the much, much lower numbers that you desire. But a report like this, which could be generated on every build, whether the build is a daily build, or whether the build is a nightly build, or whether it's a continuous integration build, can provide some very powerful statistics and numbers for you to sit together as a team of stakeholders and evaluate the progress that your team is making against software. The next recipe is about, it builds on the test-driven development recipe, and this is about the notion of continuous quality enablement. So in very simple terms, what this particular pattern attempts to solve is this notion of balancing agility and quality. This is a tough problem. You want to be moving really fast, but at the same time, you also want to make sure that you have the needed levels of quality. So continuous quality enablement, the basic theme is that don't look at software testing as a sequential activity that happens after development. Such a cadence is more about quality afterthought versus quality enablement. Quality assurance and quality enablement are two very different concepts. Assurance is more about, hey, you built the software, I'm now going to go validate the software to assure that it meets needs. Versus enablement is more about, I'm going to, from the get-go, enable and make sure that I can do everything that I can do to ensure that the software has quality baked into it from the get-go. Quality begins with defining the right product. So we spoke a little bit about collaborative ideation. That's where quality begins. When you have the right requirements, you've already eliminated a lot of unknowns that could surface later and cause quality concerns. It then continues from there into the other aspects such as architecting for quality, designing for quality, continuously validating quality. And in the process of validating quality, being able to engage the right stakeholders who need to be engaged at the right times to help you validate the quality, such as engaging users in testing iterations. Users are best qualified to give you the feedback that you need to hear about experiences, about user interface features, because they are eventually the people who are going to end up using your software. So rather than wait to engage them in a formal UAT iteration, engaging them earlier and frequently would be a very good thing for you to be able to block tackle issues soon. And quality also goes down into developer productivity, right? How can your developers more effectively engage in code review loops? How can they basically get a good understanding of what is the technical debt that they are accumulating? Because sometimes when you have to ship fast, you're going to make trade-offs. When you make trade-offs, you need to know when you're making a trade-off so that you can come back and fix the trade-off. So having the insight into how the code aligns with or deviates from designs and architecture is also a very key need, so that eventually you can come back and address the technical debt that you might choose to make a trade-off on in the short term. But most importantly, end-to-end traceability is also key. So I showed you an example of a report that could give you such end-to-end traceability. And when these recipes are all done well, essentially what you end up getting the business value of is balancing quality with agility. So this is a section which I will drill down a little bit more deeply into and show you some screenshots that will actually explain some of these concepts to you a little bit more deeper. And let's start with the first one, which is about the software testing toolbox. So testing is not a binary zero or one. There is no like one perfect tool or practice that can give you all the benefits of testing to proactively enable quality. The approach that is most effective is this notion of a toolbox. Essentially, a toolbox which has a collection of practices, which has a collection of tools, from within which you can pick the right tool to use for a given test workload. So this particular visual that you see here is actually taken from a book called Agile Testing. If you haven't read that book, I would strongly recommend that as a read. It's a fantastic book that basically goes into the theoretical and conceptual aspects of how to think about building your quality toolbox and how do you think about using the right tools and the right services and engaging the right people to test your product throughout your life cycle. So what I'll do here is sort of summarize the key notion, which is represented in this visual. The reality is testing tools vary across a broad spectrum. You've got developer style testing, which can be done through unit testing practices and by more deep code investments. And then you've got sort of like scripted tools, such as your load and performance testing tools. You've got manual testing tools, you've got exploratory testing tools, and essentially a collection of these different tools form your testing toolbox from which you have to know which practice and which tool to apply given a particular situation. The general notion is that when you're thinking about pure back-end technology and service edge type quality assurances, going with automated testing practices is going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. A way to think about your software architecture is to take a service-oriented approach where pretty much all your infrastructure, including your data layers, get abstracted by highly scalable services. And when your services kind of form the facade that your user interfaces interact with and also sort of form the layer that sit atop your infrastructural investments, the benefits that you gain is flexibility in swapping in and out infrastructure backends and in sort of isolating the user interface from having to deal with all the quality and testing workloads for validating the functionality. So the more and more you invest in services, which will also become a key design point as we start moving more and more towards exploring cloud-type opportunities, the greater your opportunities for you to automate and sort of scale out your testing investments to take advantage of such practices. Yeah. Got it. Do you want me to repeat something? Okay, got it. Right. So essentially the thinking here, the concept here is the fact that knowing when to pick the right tool and use it is very, very critical. Using automated tests for your services layer is the way to go. And when you have a rich services layer, you really have to ask yourself the question about when do you invest in user interface testing versus when do you not invest in user interface testing. So in my old team, one of the experiences that we shifted was the notion of trying to test every capability at the user interface layer. Like my team about 3 years back used to run user acceptance tests, where in every user acceptance test, we would go in and give the users a 50 or 60 page document that we would have them sit and walk through, clicking through a variety of different screens to test the software. There were two non-optimal aspects about that practice. The first non-optimal practice was the fact that the first time the users were ever seeing the product was in the UAT phase. The second non-optimal practice was that when doing the user acceptance testing, the users would also be checking for things like edge cases, boundary conditions, exception conditions, and so on and so forth. What we realized was that what the user really should be focusing on testing from a user interface perspective is the happy path flows, is the flows that he or she is going to be exercising and using on a normal basis. And pretty much all the efforts around the exception condition testing, the edge case condition testing, and whatnot could actually be moved into automated tests that were executed against the services layer. So we shifted the cadence where we made sure that all the business logic validation and edge cases and exception conditions got automated into automated tests that ran on every build, that ran on every integration, and then reduced the size of the UAT manual from like 50 plus pages into like a much smaller document, which only needed the users to click through and make sure that the user interface met their happy path functional criteria, with the guarantee that all the exception conditions were being exercised and trapped at the services layer. The second big shift that we made was that we stopped engaging the users only in the UAT phase. Instead, we shifted to a cadence where the users would start working with us early and frequently throughout the software lifecycle. We shifted to a cadence where we were dropping bits into the UAT environment on a weekly basis versus at the end of every release. And when we were able to do that, we were able to get to a mode where our users were able to engage with us more early and frequently to provide feedback on the software. And there is nothing like having your actual users test the user interface, because your users are the people who are going to end up using it and who know what they want out of it. Another key benefit that we also shifted towards in my old team was around the notion of engaging users through the use of visual artifacts. So when we were working in the team, we did not have PowerPoint storyboarding, which I showed you earlier. So what we used to use was Sketchflow. We used to use Sketchflow to basically sketch out the UIs and do prototypes. and then engage users in helping us validate those prototypes early in the life cycle so that we made sure that we actually captured the requirements in a clean and simple way. So simple benefits like that, engaging users in the right time, moving tests to an automated layer where it made sense, helped us achieve significant gains in efficiency from a quality perspective, which we did not have before when we were executing in a pure waterfall fashion. And more specifically in a waterfall fashion where all the testing was being done using manual tools. So the basic idea of this diagram is to give you a food for thought around what are the kinds of tools that you need to be looking for in your testing solution. When you invest in a testing solution, do you have a testing solution that has these types of capabilities? And assuming that it does, how do you then as an engineering team think about picking and applying the right solution for the right problem and the right scenario? So again, this was a very sort of like an overview introduction to this concept. A highly recommended book for you to read is a book called Agile Testing. If you haven't read it, get a copy of it, and that goes a lot more deeper into some of these practices, which you will be able to apply effectively to start uplifting your quality workloads. So that being said, let me now show you a few scenarios in the context of capabilities within the product. And the product here is specifically the next release of Visual Studio, which is Visual Studio 2012. So here is a screenshot that shows you how you can initiate feedback loops with your users on an early and frequent basis. So think of this as tying to the scenario that I mentioned earlier, where we used to make drops to a UAT environment on a weekly basis, sometimes even on a daily basis, depending on the type of application being built. And we would have a set of users who are committed to helping us test the software early and often throughout the life cycle. So the feedback request capability that you will see in VS 2012, and which Alex will hopefully demonstrate to you later today live, will help you sort of like select users during your life cycle and to send them requests to validate your software and to give you back feedback. And the beauty of this capability is that you can actually request feedback for a particular product backlog item or for a particular work item. So essentially what this helps you achieve is traceability, where the feedback that you request is initiated from a backlog item. The feedback that the user submits gets attached to the same backlog item so that the developer and the tester working on the backlog item have constant visibility into what their users are thinking about and would like to see in the product that's being developed. So this next screenshot shows what happens when the user actually gets the request. So the user gets the request, and in the request, there's a link that they can click. And when they click that link, this launches the tool that is called the feedback client. And the feedback client will basically display any instructions that the developer or the tester provided to the user. And the user can follow those instructions to launch the application, to start testing the application, and can also capture and provide feedback on his experience back to the developer or the tester. So if you look on the left, there are a variety of options. The user can choose to just record his entire session. Like he can basically record the entire screen with his voice as he's walking through the scenario, so any comments that he verbally expresses can be captured. Or the user can choose to record only his voice, his or her voice. Or the user can choose to take screen snapshots and attach those screen snapshots into the comments that he provides as feedback. And finally, when the user submits the feedback with all the rich information that was collected gets directly attached back to the worklog, to the backlog item that the developer or the tester is working on. So by using a process like this, the development team can continuously engage their users in feedback loops and get very actionable feedback that they can then incorporate into their next steps to complete the feature. The next screenshot talks about some collaborative capabilities that are now built deeply into Visual Studio itself in the context of enabling quality with more of a developer focus. So in this case, the scenario is peer code reviews, where from within your new Team Explorer window, you can initiate code review loops, and a developer can essentially pick a module of code and request another developer on his or her team to provide feedback on it. So in this case, for instance, you are seeing a developer sort of like submit a request to one of his peers, asking him or her to check out the exception handling pattern that he has used in his particular code. So when the request gets submitted, the request gets routed to the person who requested, who needs to do the code review. And this screenshot shows what that person can do. So this person can actually literally compare different states of the code, can comment on the code, and can send the feedback back to the reviewer. And all of this feedback, the request, the responses, everything gets tracked and attached to the work item of relevance to this code. So the key point to keep in mind in the last couple of scenarios that I've shown you is the notion of end-to-end traceability. End-to-end traceability, where whether it is feedback requests or whether it is code review comments, every one of these aspects get tracked down to the work item level. And this gives you the full traceability from requirements to code to tests to code reviews to whatnot. So you get that end-to-end traceability of every step and action that is taken throughout the software lifecycle. There are also a number of emerging practices that are starting to occur in the modern web industry around this notion of continuous quality verifications through this practice of continuous integration, which is, again, a very essential practice when you're building high velocity and high scale applications and services. The concept is fairly straightforward. It's rather than validating your quality at infrequent intervals, shifting to a cadence where you have a set of tests that are run every time you build your product. So continuous integration basically is a mechanism wherein, like, you're with every build that you check into the repository, there are a set of tests that get executed against that build to make sure that the build is of high quality and that it doesn't break an existing build. So there are different configuration options which can be used depending on the nature of the software being built and depending on the appetite of the development team itself. So CI sort of runs builds on every single check-in. A more advanced form of CI is the notion of gated check-ins, where the code won't even make it into the repository unless it passes the set of tests on the developer's environment itself. So this is a further level of safeguarding where a developer is first expected to sort of synchronize the tests back into his or her own environment, run those tests, make sure that the code passes the tests, and then check the code into the repository. So that's also a good practice that is used in some of the more higher scale service engineering organizations. And the other options that you have is to basically do things like nightly builds or builds that are essentially scheduled at your own convenience and frequencies. But if you're investing in high scale services, if you're investing in software that evolves at a very rapid pace, and specifically if you're investing in software that gets developed by team members, by multiple team members who could be distributed, then getting into a cadence where you're sort of like running your build verification tests and your quality checks early and often throughout the lifecycle, ideally as quickly as possible with your build check-ins, is a highly recommended practice. So there's a lot more to quality enablement, but kind of what I showed you was like three different edges. One edge which focused on how do you engage your users in validating quality early and often. The other edge which talked a little bit about how do sort of your developers sort of collaborate with each other in verifying and validating quality. And the third aspect was about how can you enforce some build, deploy, test workflows that will help you validate your quality on a continuous basis. But over and beyond that, there are also a few other recipes and demos and patterns that can be applied. And the slide deck, which when shared with you, has certain notes around what those demos would be. And you should also talk to Alex and Dimitri to understand a little bit more about aspects of quality enablement that I was not able to cover in this talk today. The next pattern is about collaborative pivoting. So this pattern basically acknowledges the fact that in any software development project during the life cycle, you will run into certain unknowns. Change is sort of inevitable. Change is inevitable, and running into some unknown problems is also inevitable. Now, these problems may be caused due to sort of like mismatched expectations, which should hopefully be resolved when applying the other patterns such as collaborative ideation and continuous testing. But they could also occur due to certain unknowns such as team members quitting the team or team members being out sick or kind of like a particular work item taking a much longer time than what it was estimated to take. So there could be a variety of reasons that basically cause delays after the software milestone has been initiated. Now, the typical problem here is when such problems occur, the users don't typically tend to get engaged in conversations to help mitigate those issues. Instead, the team tries to push through and get to what they can get to, and then eventually when the user gets to see the completed software, he or she can at times feel that what was delivered was not what was promised. So the solution pattern here is that just as how you engage your users in defining the software, and just as how you engage your users in validating the software, it's also a good practice to engage your users in helping make corrective and course correction decisions when you run into issues during your software development process. So the notion of crack user representatives, the word crack is actually from the lean engineering philosophy. It stands for communicative, responsive, authorized, collaborative, and knowledgeable. So the lean engineering practices essentially require that you have crack user representatives who are deeply embedded into the development team and who are authorized to provide the needed feedback and to make the needed decisions on behalf of the user basis. When you have such users deeply embedded in your team, the value that you can gain in the context of getting early feedback, in the context of getting frequent input, and in the context of helping them help you scope your software can be very, very effective. This was one of the big practices that we applied in the digital supply chain services team, where we used to have crack user representatives from our business teams engaged in our development organization. And the maximum value that we used to get from these users was not just in helping them help us test the software, but was also in helping them help us make the needed adjustments when things did not go right. So examples of value that we used to get were situations where a user would, for instance, stand up and say that, hey, the testing that you want to execute is a manual user interface testing. Your tester is not available or had to take a vacation or take an unplanned timeout. So let me step in and help you run the test. Assign the work item to me in the backlog and I can go execute the test because it's a manual UI test and it does not need me to write code. Another example is where the users can help you define good, better, best experiences. So you might, for instance, choose to deliver the best experience in a sprint. But then you might discover that that best experience is going to take a much longer time to deliver. What better way to solve that than working with your user to maybe help you define a better or even a good experience that could still add value, that could still make the world a lot better than what it is today, but without necessarily delivering the best possible capability? So in this kind of a scenario, you can still collaborate with your user to scope down the needs to something that would still add value, which you can land in the same time frame, and then continue to build upon that in subsequent iterations to increment the value and to deliver something that is even better. And a very interesting thing that we used to find in some of these situations was that what we ended up scoping down to, like a better or a good solution, would at times end up being sufficient to solve the problems that our users had. Which means what we thought was the best solution or the best option to deliver value was actually a more expensive and a more over-engineering investment than the value that was delivered even with a good or a better option. So engaging your users deeply in conversations around defining these kinds of good, better, best options and being able to fall back to these options with their input and feedback is something that can really help you make the needed adjustments as you go through the development cycle and discover some unknowns. So in the next release of our product, essentially what you'll end up seeing is a very, very deeply integrated out-of-the-box experience for managing these kinds of agile interactions. So in this particular case, for instance, what you're seeing is a backlog that you could sit and walk through with your users. But what is really interesting here is if you look on the right, there is a lot of directly relevant real-time analytics, which gives you insight into the burn down of the team, and which also gives you insight into the utilization of the team. And what you can do here is work with your users to sit down and have an objective conversation about the time that is left, about the people utilization. And you could make adjustments to the scope based on very real data that sort of reflects the status of the team. In some cases, these adjustments would be scoping down certain work items to a lower end experience. And in some cases, it might be actually reprioritizing and moving some of these work items out into a future sprint while still managing to deliver an acceptable bar of value. Another capability that you'll also see is this notion of visual or agile task boards, which can also be used to manage tasks and make adjustments in a very visual fashion. So in this particular case, for instance, there's a work item which is taking longer than what was forecasted or expected. So imagine being able to talk to your users and identify a more lower-end experience for the same solution, for the same need, but a solution that could be implemented in a much shorter duration, which could then reduce the number of work hours needed to deliver this, thereby still helping the team to pull through the activity within the planned time frame. So while the value delivered may not have been the best possible value, it is still good value that helps move the needle forward for the users. And then based on the learning, you might then choose that you want to continue to increment the value, or you may discover that the new scoped down value actually does the job of giving your users what they want. But having these kinds of visual tools where you can sit with your users and evaluate the status of your progress and make the needed course correcting decisions can be a very powerful and effective way for you to collaborate. The last pattern I'm going to talk about is DevOps, but before diving into this, I'll request Dimitri to play the second video that I wanted to show.
Now this is your last chance. I've been more than reasonable. Fetchinavash! Quoi? Fetchinavash! Jesus Christ! Oh! Right. George!
Tear them apart.
No.
Sir, I have a plan.
All right. Did you get any laughs or smiles for that? All right, so moving on to this pattern. So this pattern is what is starting to get popularly referred to in the industry as the DevOps problem or the DevOps solution, whichever way you may choose to look at it. The problem here is very simple. I mean, there exists a barrier between the development and the operations function, which can become a very significant inhibitor to your ability to deliver value with velocity. This is also commonly known as your last mile velocity or your last mile impediments. Because no matter how fast you might move in defining requirements, no matter how fast you might move in being able to develop your software, at the end of the day, if you cannot get it deployed into production and operated, then the value materialization is not going to happen. So the DevOps practices are really about how do you take those specific pain points that exist between development and operations and deliver solutions to help make them more efficient and acceptable. So this term tends to be viewed as a very modern, high-end term, but in reality, it's a very simple concept that solves very real problems that exist today in IT departments when applied effectively and when supported with the right tools and solutions. So again, as in the case of users and testers, operations is not something that should be viewed as an afterthought. Like, the worst thing that you can do is try and deal with operational checklists and operational requirements just when you're ready to deploy your software into production. You know, and not understanding the operations requirements clearly early in the milestone can also sort of result in you building software that is not operationally ready. So thinking about operations also as an end-to-end lifecycle engagement cadence, you know, where it begins with making sure that operational requirements are captured as acceptance test requirements. So if you go back to the acceptance test-driven development pattern, which you spoke about earlier, one of the criteria that you want to start thinking about defining when you define the acceptance criteria is what are the operational readiness needs that your software needs to be able to satisfy? and capturing those as testable requirements and making sure that those tests pass early and often will then help you address the challenge of meeting the operations backlog required or the operations checklist requirements later in the cycle. The best way for you to satisfy the operations checklist is by showing that those checklist needs have been implemented as tests, and those tests have been guaranteed to pass, which then provides a very objective input into the readiness of your software from an operations perspective. There are other operational workloads that are also of significance to the development team, such as lab management. So when you wish to basically set up and tear down labs, both for build purposes and for testing workloads, and being able to do such setup and tear down at very rapid velocities and on demand can be a pretty challenging operations task. So lab management has been a capability in Team Foundation servers since the earlier versions, but what is new in the 2012 version that is to be released shortly is the fact that now you can do lab management against standard environments. So in the previous versions, you had to set up System Center. You had to set up virtual machines using System Center Virtual Machine Manager for you to be able to take advantage of this feature. But now in 2012, you can actually have your own standard server environments, which may not be set up and managed using System Server, but which you can still take and integrate into your lab management capabilities. And our investments are not going to stop there, because going down into the future, we are also starting to explore directions about how can you sort of like stand up and tear down lab machines in the public cloud. Like, what if you have a cloud provider who gives you VM capabilities in the cloud that you would like to utilize to stand up and tear down labs, thereby reducing your infrastructure workloads to manage such environments? So once you get past that, there are then other workloads around making sure that your deployment processes can be automated so that you don't have operations folks sitting down and babysitting manual deployments and configuration of software. And then eventually, once your software does get deployed, making sure that you have rich tools and mechanisms to gather diagnostics data about problems that occur in production, specifically capabilities that will help you capture data that your developers can directly act on to solve. So it's one thing, for example, to generate an AVI code log in System Center, but taking the AVI code output and transforming that into an IntelliTrace log, which your developers can then act upon from within Visual Studio, will enable a whole different level of sophistication and productivity for your developers to isolate problems. So we'll talk a little bit more about that particular scenario when I go later into this talk. But integrated incident management is all about a couple of things. It's about integrating tools that operations people use to manage incidents with the tools that development teams use to track work items, and making sure that any bugs or incidents that are reported by operations can have information that is directly actionable by the development team to solve the problems. And then the operation learnings are not just about problems. They're also about validating the value hypotheses of your software. So when you have the right level of metrics, instrumentation, and gathering, you can also validate to make sure that your software and services are delivering on the business value that was envisioned. So for instance, if the business value that you envisioned for an e-commerce site optimization was increased sales, then you need to be able to have metrics that will help track the sales data and compare the sales data that you get after the feature was deployed versus before to see if the needed benefit was actually delivered. So when you truly integrate your development and your operations teams, you end up getting two significant business value benefits. The velocity of your last mile execution gets a lot faster, and your mean time to repair starts getting lowered. And especially in a services environment or in any environment where you have a broad set of connected device applications that are being powered by continuous services, the ability to recover from downtime and the ability to sort of make sure that you can deploy patches to issues in a very fast and agile manner is critically important. So DevOps solutions and recipes will help you address these kinds of challenges. So the first screenshot here talks about investments that we are continuing to make in deeply integrating operations tools with development tools. And this particular feature that you're seeing here is in the context of System Center, where from within System Center Operations Manager, operations folks can pick incidents that they are observing and assign those incidents to engineering, which in turn will result in the incident being directly translated and attached onto a TFS item that the team will then get alerted upon and can take action upon. Another compelling feature is the ability for you to now take IntelliTrace. So IntelliTrace always existed on the client side, but now imagine having IntelliTrace capabilities on the server side without having to install Visual Studio on the server. So by just unzipping a cap file which has a certain set of core DLLs into your server environments, and your server environment could be your SIT environment, it could be your user acceptance test environment, it could be your stress testing environment, or your production environment. But essentially, you can now have IntelliTrace activated on your servers. You can generate IntelliTrace logs when you notice certain exception conditions or performance conditions on the server. And then you can attach those IntelliTrace logs to TFS items that developers can then open and help address. So when a developer gets a TFS item with an IntelliTrace log, he or she can open the IntelliTrace log in Visual Studio and can have full historical insight into the events that occurred leading up to the instance of the problem. So one of the big differences between IntelliTrace debugging and traditional debugging is, like, unlike as in traditional debugging, where you sort of like set a breakpoint and attach onto the debugger when the breakpoint is hit, in historical debugging, you essentially get a collection of events that are logged over a period of time leading up to the problem, and where these events also capture all the relevant state information associated with them, which means you now have the ability to open up these logs in Visual Studio, step back and forth through the events that occurred, and at every phase have insight into the state elements that were collected of relevance to that event. So the amount of information that you choose to collect or not collect in the IntelliTrace can be configured using the IntelliTrace plans. So the IntelliTrace plans are XML documents that you can go and edit to specify which assemblies to capture events from, all the way down to like which methods you would like to trace and what kinds of parameters you would like to get information about and whatnot. Completely configurable experience and can be very powerful in helping your operations folks provide actionable data to your developers. So this screenshot shows an example of where an IntelliTrace log that was captured by the operations person was sent to the development team, and the development team opened up the log from within Visual Studio. And on the right, for instance, you can see the series of events, the historical events that were captured throughout the course of the log. And in this particular case, the developer was able to drill down into a particular exception all the way through to the source code, and then in the source code sort of detect what was causing the null reference exception that was shown in the stack. So when you look at the locals window, for instance, you can notice that the assigned to field is the one that was assigned the null value, and the null value being unacceptable caused the null reference exception. So typically in a situation like this, what you would do is you would not just fix the code, but you would also make sure that you go back and reinstate a test case that can help prevent the regression of this kind of a defect after you've deployed the patch into production. So this is an example, and later on in the session, later in the day, you should see a live demonstration of IntelliTrace capabilities, hopefully, which will show you this similar functionality showing working in action. So those really were the six solution patterns and the different sort of like impediments that they can help address throughout the course of the application lifecycle to give you better productivity. Now, the key point to again take away is that every one of those patterns address contextual problems. And depending on which problem is most important to you or is most significant to you, you can choose to pick and apply one or more of these patterns contextually to your development processes. So a strong recommendation would be for folks to take a look at the development practices, look for opportunities where there could be better optimizations, and to think about which pattern would make the most sense and which recipes within those patterns would make the most sense to apply and try achieve better optimization benefits. What we're showing you here is essentially a full stack view of the Microsoft ALM solution. So at the core of our ALM solution is Team Foundation Server. And for those of you who may not be aware, we are also working on an early preview version of a cloud-based version of Team Foundation capabilities, which is known as the Team Foundation Service. And if you want to check out the service, you can go to tfspreview.com. Currently, access to the service requires you to request and obtain codes to be able to start exercising the service. But in the future, at some point, we will quickly lift the need to, we'll be able to accept your request to join the service without requiring any invitation codes. So think of this service at this point as agile planning tools in the cloud, source code management in the cloud, build services in the cloud, both scheduled builds and continuous integration builds. And currently, it's in a very early preview stage, and we're continuing to work on and evolve that. And the goal is not to necessarily replace the on-premise edition of Team Foundation Server, because the reality is that hybrid IT is the mode of operation for most businesses in the near foreseeable, potentially for the ever foreseeable future. And by hybrid IT, what we mean is infrastructures that span local on-premise servers, private clouds that are managed by organizations, and public clouds. And this option here basically gives you the ability to think about how can you split your workloads to both take advantage of the new economies that the cloud can enable for you, and in the context of helping you sort. Okay, sounds good. So you get the picture. I mean, I'll let you guys drill down into this and get into more details around this. But the picture should basically give the message that that it should give you a good view of what the different products are. So we'll quickly jump through these screenshots. What these screenshots really talk about is the fact that TFS is also an open platform. We have built integrations into Eclipse and into Java platforms, so you can also leverage the server capabilities from within these IDEs. And finally, closing back with like the Uber cause of ALM, you know, where the core message here is the focus of ALM is to enable teams without barriers, and we walk through some patterns that will help you do that, and which when done well will help you achieve the benefits of value delivery and business modernization. So with that being said, that's the end of the presentation. That's the end of the talk that I wanted to give you folks, and we'll be happy to shift into a Q&A mode and take questions that you have.
Oh, we have no time to Q&A. Sorry, it's a break. Time for a break. Thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you.
Audience is applauding you. Thank you.
Thank you.
У нас перерыв. Спасибо. Встретимся на следующей сессии.